You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 20th of December 2014 on Monocle 24.
New launches and diehard classics that are going from strength to strength, editors with nous and creatives with conviction from Bristol to Hamburg. Independent or commercial, today the magazine landscape has never looked more colourful. We pick up the print kaleidoscope together with a set of binoculars and take a look back at the year that was 2014 here on The Stack. This week on The Stack, we review the year in print with two of our most trusted magazine voices, who bring to the table their ponderings and predictions from either end of the industry spectrum. Plus, we meet a man who knows a thing or two about printing a high-quality product, Monsieur Prosper Asseline.
All of the book together talk to the same style of client. So it's a niche people in London, niche people in Singapore, niche people in Venice. So all of these niche people are enough for us to do a business.
Plus, we go to Germany, where one crafty new title is also getting creative with paper and drawing in the crowds.
It's a magazine for paper lovers. It's a magazine that you can read and you can feel it, because it's made with different types of paper and with paper goodies in it as well.
All that and plenty more besides on this 2014 review special of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to this 121st edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. As promised, today we'll have a bit of an annual review on the show. With launches of independent titles hitting the roof over the past 12 months, it might be easy to say that the magazine sector is booming once more. But here on The Stack, we've also charted how 2014 continued to be a topsy-turvy year for more traditional titles. So, while September issues were at their fattest to date and ad sales for many titles on both sides of the Atlantic seem to level pre-crisis numbers, some are not so cheerful. The magazine is clearly in a state of flux, and with winners must come some losers. As we charted on the show, retail and distribution pressures, amongst other forces, have also cast a cloud over magazine expansion. Well, to discuss all of this and much more besides, today we are joined by two regulars to the programme, Ian Birch, who is Editorial Development Director at Hearst here in the UK, and another friend of the programme, certainly has been across the studio, because it's a rather packed Midori house as we run up to the holidays. Steve Watson is here from the distribution business, Stack Magazines. I feel it's a little bit unfair to call it a distribution business, but we do know that, as we were saying in the intro of the programme, logistics and distribution are everything. And as Ian will well know, because we've tried to sort of appeal to the forces on the other side of the Atlantic, it's incredibly tricky. For people who aren't familiar, Steve, with what Stack Magazines does, I would hope most Stack listeners would know at this point. Just tell us a little bit about your business.
Sure. So very, very briefly, people subscribe, and every month I send them a different independent magazine. Never know what you're going to get next, but you do know it's going to be one of these beautiful, intelligent magazines you probably wouldn't have seen before. And you wouldn't have seen it because you say distribution is everything, and distribution's pretty shocking. Mm. So these magazines, they have a really hard time getting in front of people.
Mm. Ian, you represent, of course, a company which is also very much in the distribution game as well. And it's always amazing when you speak to people who might be at a company like yours or one of the big competitors who also are somewhat vertically integrated still. Even if you own the business, there are still so many moving parts to it as well that are just well beyond your control. Doesn't matter where you are in the world.
No, right? Absolutely. And we've seen that quite a lot this year, because, there's been so much pressure on so many distribution outlets.
A very high-profile bankruptcy in the absolutely. United States, which decimated, not just channels, but I think also probably, the fortunes, I think, for many other people who are in the sector.
Yeah, and I'm sure it won't be the last either. So we are always looking at different distribution outlets. Mm. And I think that's something that's going to happen more and more in the next year, 2 years. We've got to find other areas to basically sell our product.
I mean, we've seen so many companies in a variety of sectors, Ian, whether they're airlines, everyone talks about, the fashion for unbundling and getting out of core businesses, which means, of course, selling things off and hopefully either sort of, releasing them for slightly lower fees and just, really sort of just getting out of many areas which people just, see are not the main sort of focus for their business. Do you think we move more in that direction with big publishers? They say, we don't want to be the distribution business, or they say, no, we have to go the other way because we just have to get this right because we have to save the sector. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, well, I think one of the big kind of buzz phrases at the moment in the more traditional companies is the word membership. Mm. So traditionally it was newsstand, and subscription was a secondary, unlike the US where subscription is everything. There's more and more thinking around how we do subscription. And this new word membership has been very much bubbling up in 2014. So rather than being a straightforward, I buy a subscription to a brand, I now want to be part of that brand as many different touch points as possible. So you feel that you're a member of a club, you feel that you're a member of a community. And that's quite a fundamentally different way of looking at the whole kind of access to the brand.
I mean, Steve, in many ways, that's what you've done with Stack Magazines. Is there a temptation, though, to go beyond, let's say, the current model, which, you know, obviously is offering people, you know, something interesting every month and say, well, we have this database already. Can we offer a plethora of other services, not turning into Amazon? No, but certainly saying, you know, maybe we should be handling other, let's say, traditional subscription channels for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have two big plans for next year, which I'm
happy to reveal.
Unfortunately, not used on my list here. You see business plans. So I have two business plans to write over Christmas, and they will be absolutely about finding better ways to get magazines in front of people. Because I really believe that we are still buying and selling magazines as if the internet doesn't exist. Even when we're selling stuff online, you look at, and there's tons and tons of places to buy magazines, and you look at the website, and they're all the same. And the Stack back issues pages is exactly the same. Rows and rows of covers, as if you were standing in WH Smith's just looking at a load of stuff. And it's like, it makes no sense. Now that we live in this digital age that we do, there are so many more opportunities. And so I've been thinking a lot about this, and I think I've come up with two ways, and so I'm going to be trying to noodle that out over Christmas.
Okay, right. So we'll come back to you then in February. Hopefully we'll give you sort of a month's breathing period, and then we can come back and hear what they are. Sorry, Ian.
No, I think it's a really good point. Really good point, because I think there are lots of different ways of slicing and dicing it, you know, so there's all this great content. If we could extract that content and focus it around the communities that really like that content.
Yep.
So in a really kind of crude way, if you have a great piece around Iraq, then you appeal to those communities and you target them directly. And I think increasingly we're going to be doing that kind of, it's an awful phrase, that niche marketing.
It's interesting you mentioned Amazon before, because that's exactly what Amazon are doing already with everything else. Yeah. So, if they wanted to, they could get into the game of saying, well, what's on the cover of the new Monocle? Let's target the people who've bought stuff related to that. Something tells me they're not that interested in doing that. But, they're keeping it simple. Facebook already offers that. You know, the amazing granularity you can get into with people's interests and things they already follow, that stuff's just sitting there. It's just waiting to be used.
Do you think we still, this conversation has moved completely digital, but still we're talking about print. Do we move to a place where there are no longer traditional magazine stores and outlets? We've, of course, chronicled the disappearance of one much-loved and very active newsstand in this neighborhood that went away, partly just because of the pressures of rents and everything else. Very hard, as an area becomes more affluent, to still maintain a traditional newsstand. Do you think all of this goes digital? Because there is still that sampling side. There's that still the logistics component. You sometimes just want, you do crack a spine of a magazine. You think, this is not for me. And then there's the other equation as well. I think a lot of people as well, do they really want to think that they're financing UPS both ways if they don't like it? Which I think does become this, I think, sort of, new environmental question in the back of many people's minds. What happens with the physical distribution, or at least or the retail side, Ian, do you think?
Right. Well, I'm a big fan of venues, places to go into, and I would fight to the end to try and keep them. But obviously, we need to do them differently. If you look at Waterstones, so Waterstones recently looked like they might finally be going into the black after about five, 6 years of being in the red. Whether you like it or not, they have significantly changed Waterstones outlets. So yes, they brought in coffee chains, they brought in toys, they brought in this, but they brought in that. But the thing is, they have actually led to selling more books. It's got more of an atmosphere.
And I think they're adding more magazines.
And they're adding more magazines. So I think we need to think much more kind of radically around what that sort of meeting point should be for magazines. Now, I think we can do more than just bringing in a Starbucks franchise, because I think the world has had enough coffee shops, But I think there are other things we can do, and they could all be linked in with communities, subscriptions, targeting, whatever.
Seeing what future for the traditional space of bricks, mortar, and a few shelves?
Yeah, there's absolutely no question. We need independent bookshops. We need independent magazine shops. If nothing else, because these are the places where people talk about the web as this kind of, this great savior, but the reality is you still need to somehow be pointed at stuff. You don't walk past anything on the web. Whereas, you walk past...
Because you need serendipity.
Exactly. You can walk in and then you can pick these things up and you can decide whether they're for you. So they have to be there. I think that the wider question is, and again, you touched on it already, but is on the structures behind it. So, the fact is that at the moment it does not work, or it doesn't work well enough for small independents to get their stuff out. And so I think there's a lot of work to do behind the scenes to try to put that together.
Mm. Well, Steve, you didn't show me yours, but I'm going to show you mine. I am happy to say, though, we haven't really revealed it yet, but we are going to open up a magazine store, a good old... corner. We found a corner shop in Paddington, and cool. It won't be branded. It'll be from us, but it won't be branded by us. And we're going to see if we can improve how it's done.
Fantastic.
And do many things that you've done. Do some of the things that your friends at Condé Nast haven't done. So the idea that if we just created a space which was exclusively Monocle, that would be fine. But we've already got our own stores, but we think something needs to happen in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. That makes WH Smith snap to attention. That even makes some of the independents snap to attention, because I think it's always interesting when people talk about, you love this newsstand. And again, we've talked about this before. You might love that one newsstand in New York, and you think, well, why can you be one of the most respected Indian-run newsstands in New York, and you have cousins running it in London, and you don't have the same racking and stacking system? There's something about the good old independent New York newsstand which works, incredibly well. And somehow, in London, we haven't sort of found that sort of same system where you can get all of the facings in place. So we want to look at sort of best practice, take the things that can actually inspire independent operators, and that just doesn't mean sort of the funky bunch, the Magmas and everybody else. It's also just, the mom and pop operations as well.
Excellent. Looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. Well, end of Q1.
Sounds great.
Builders go in on Friday, and listeners for the program, you'll hear a little bit more about that. You're listening to a very special, almost year-end edition of The Stack with me, Tyler Briley, also our guest today, Ian Birch and Steve Watson. I'm going away for a short break. We're back after this.
A fresh generation is falling in love with Warsaw's Mokotów neighbourhood, so Monocle Films headed to Poland to experience the palpable vibrancy of this creative community.
I feel like here everyone is very kind of patriotic about being a Mokotów inhabitant. There's this feeling of growth and optimism here. So I would say that's what creates our attachment to this area.
Property Perspective Mokotów. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack with me, Tyler Briley, Ian Birch and Steve Watson. Now, if you haven't done all your Christmas shopping and you wanted to get something rather special for that print-obsessed loved one, a gift from the gentleman featured next might do the trick. Asseline Publishing is a luxury book publisher based in New York, but started in Paris by husband and wife Prosper and Martine Asseline, with a focus on images and with indulgent printing and paper stock throughout. Asseline have won the reputation as being the world's most sophisticated publishers. Maybe up for debate. 2014 also saw the launch of a beautiful retail space in London's Piccadilly. Our Daniel Giacopelli spoke to Prosper Asseline about how it all began.
It was not the intention to create a publishing company when I began, because it was, I was in the printing. All of my life was around magazine advertising, so I knew what was a print. But I never published a book. And the first book what we published, it was just a beautiful moment we wanted to share with few people. And it was about an hotel in south of France. The name is La Colombe d'Or. So I decided to take the picture, and I'm not a photographer. And my wife decided to write the text, and she's not a writer. So we decided to accomplish this book. And I wanted to do it with no aggressivity. I didn't want to show the famous people who are going to the hotel. I didn't want to show really the hotel at all. I wanted to show the shadows. I wanted to make it like a movie. So we mixed 50% of the past, 50% of today. like a recipe, we take what we find in the fridge and we create something.
And your books are called the most sophisticated books in the world. That's like the motto, the tagline, the mission. I'm wondering what types of mental and physical and financial energy goes into making that a reality. That's a very bold mission you have.
Yeah, but when I say sophisticated, it's not with pretentious, it's because it is not for everybody. And all of the book together talk to the same style of client. So it's a niche people in London, niche people in Singapore, niche people in Venice. So all of these niche people are enough for us to do a business.
And you've made a very conscious decision to have your business vertically integrated. You have your books in your own shops, and now, of course, you've opened up your new London flagship. You're in Istanbul, Mexico City, New York, and it's not only books. It's you have a bar where you could get champagne and espresso. You have leather goods. You have library furniture you and your wife have designed. Walk me through the design of a book from brainstorming to completion. I know it's all done by you guys. Who thinks of the ideas?
This is going to be pretentious, my answer, but it's a little bit obvious because we have few style of collection. And it's really with me and my wife, Martine. We travel a lot. So we are in Venice. We just opened a store in Venice. So we decided to do a book on the five synagogues in Venice in the ghetto. We are in Capri to have lunch. And we say it's impossible to not make a right book on Capri.
So it's an organic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are people pitching you ideas too?
Yes. Yeah. So we have also people who are coming, but we take one on 100 because a lot are, we don't know how to do it. And it's good, but we give it to, say, go to read the list, better. I think it's going to be good for them and good for you. And we don't know how to do it. It's the truth because we have to put a lot of us. It's a lot of our blood. It's our name. So we try to have each book really coming from us.
And that was our Daniel Giacopelli speaking to publisher Prosper Asselin. 2 points, gentlemen, that come out of that which are interesting when you listen to his business. He's going for this approach of opening his own outlets. And, you know, Ian, once upon a time, you could have walked around the streets of New York and you would have seen the likes of Doubleday and other publishers actually owning their own spaces. Now, of course, before the break, we said, you know, we might want to move into that territory as well. Do you think that there would be room for part of the Hearst franchise that you could do something with, you know, a number of brands and look at, let's say, the extension of cookbooks and back issues and all of those things? You know, could it be done with Esquire? Could you do something with Town and Country? What do you think of what Asselin is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we're looking at. So I think we're looking more and more at our archives. So we have these huge archives, which, frankly, we are not, they're not as organized as well as they might be. Mm. If you look at the Town and Country archive, it's sort of staggering, but it hasn't been digitized in any shape or form. I'm not being critical here. It just hasn't been. But when you look at the kind of quality of the contributors, the designers, the stylists, it's sort of breathtaking. Mm. And that's absolutely something we want to do, because I think you want both to sit alongside each other. The archive refreshes the modern refreshes the archive. Mm. And so I think we should, like everything else we're doing, and there's not any particularly new thinking here, but we want the brand to touch the consumer as much as possible. Mm. So if we could do some sort of bricks and mortar, and I mean, obviously we've done that with Good Housekeeping. So I mentioned this before earlier. So in October, November of this year, we opened up the Good Housekeeping Institute, which is kind of interesting step for a 94-year-old brand to do that. So it sort of shows that the brand is sturdy and flexible enough to do something like that. And it's kind of fascinating because it's really changing the perception both inside and outside of Good Housekeeping. Mm. It's a bit like a lot of brands are now turning to print to help develop the brand in a very traditional way. It's also like print brands are thinking more about physical space to give their brand a different kind of context. Mm. So what you're saying about, you know, opening up a Monocle store, it's not dissimilar to what we've been doing with Good Housekeeping. Mm. It just makes it come alive. It's exciting when you've got people in one place, all with one passion, all talking about whatever cookery class is. Mm.
Steve, the other thing that Mr. Asselin was saying that was interesting was he was talking about price and the premiums, and that they've managed to make a business out of selling incredibly expensive books. I mean, you know, 10 times what you might expect for a normal coffee table edition, but really, ultimately, not that much extra in it, if one's brutally honest. I'm looking at a stack of titles that you've brought in today. Do you think, and you know, you're obviously able to gauge probably price sensitivity via your business. If you were advising many of the publishers whose titles you're distributing, would you say, you know what, you could probably go for an extra five pounds, £10 here and there?
I actually don't get involved in that so much. So with Stack, it's the same price regardless of what we send out. And that works because of various economies of scale down the road. What I do tell publishers is that on the few occasions when I do a Jeremy Leslie and kind of set up my magazine stall, I notice that price doesn't really seem to come into it. I think it's really much more about capturing someone's imagination, selling them on the idea that this magazine is absolutely for them in that moment. They have to have it. And then if it's £10 and there's a £4 magazine next to it, they're going to buy the £10 one because that's the one that's made the connection with them.
You're listening to our special year-end edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24. When we come back, we're going to hopefully get into a couple of the titles that Steve has brought along, and we're also going to be taking a little trip to Germany as well. Stay with us.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Burley, Ian Birch and Steve Watson. Now, as we are charting the year in print on The Stack, and of course that year being 2014, it seems fitting to feature a magazine that has been a runaway success in Germany. Flow Magazine was a Dutch concept in women's magazines that was started just 12 months ago. Its editorial line is as simple as it is successful: to inspire. Crafty, cut out and collect numbers with several different paper stocks certainly make Flow very tactile. It seems to be working, as Flow is selling more than 100,000 copies per issue and has plans to expand. Earlier, we spoke to Flow's editor-in-chief, Sinja Schutte.
Flow is a new kind of magazine. It's a what we would call a Zeitgeist magazine. It's for women, basically. The idea was to create a complete new magazine for women. A magazine that is not only new from the topics and from the whole way of telling stories, it's also new that it's a magazine for paper lovers. It's a magazine that you can read and you can feel it because it's made with different types of paper and with paper goodies in it as well. The winter issue is our most important issue. It's made to be a present for our readers. We try to make our magazine a present for our readers all the time, but this particular issue is very special because it has glitter on the cover. It's so nice to touch it, and it's so nice to look at it, and it gives you just a very season feeling, I think. In the issue, we always have a calendar that you can take for the next year. It's a 365 days quote calendar. You can sort of take it out and cut it into little cards and hang it up on the wall and get a quote or a nice inspiration every day, because Flow is all about inspiration and being creative, and this calendar helps you to go through the year in a very creative and mindful way. We are very convinced that paper and reading magazines is not dead. Many people say that reading and magazines are on a decline, but we think it's modern and people love to hold it and smell it and touch it. And we saw this magazine in Holland and we thought this would be wonderful for the German market as well. We brought Flow to Germany in November 2013. And we thought maybe we would sell like 40,000 copies of it. And we started in November. And 2 weeks later, we already sold so many copies that we decided to not only bring it out four times a year, but six times a year. it was just such a huge success with lots of readers writing us that they were waiting for this type of magazine, that they love to read it and that it's so different. And we are selling at the moment up to 100,000 copies each issue. And the winter issue that is on the market right now will even be better than 100,000 copies. So I think there's still a lot of women out there who didn't find Flow yet.
And that was the editor of Flow magazine, Sinja Schutte, talking to us from Hamburg. Ian, this is a title, as mentioned, started in the Netherlands. It's now, the German edition is under a big publishing house. It's part of Gruner & Jahr, who are putting it out. Obviously, a very wily eye who spotted it. What's your impression? I mean, these are not bad numbers for also something which it's not exactly cheap. You know, it goes out for 8 euros, 12 Swiss francs, 8.20 if you buy it in Benelux. So a pretty confident cover price. What does it say to you about publishing and also just opportunity in general?
I think it's fantastic. I'm really impressed. Terrific interview. I love the idea that the paper dictates the mood or complements the mood. I think that's genuinely original, genuinely different. It's a great way of approaching a magazine because it's a completely different lens from a traditional lens. I think they're absolutely right in really focusing on a core group. 6 issues a year, absolutely right. I love the idea of it being a magazine for paper lovers. Because in all the research we have done over the last year, people keep saying that, don't take my magazine away because I like the feeling of print. Not literally, but effectively that. So I think what they've done is they've taken that basic idea and really developed it in a really, really kind of impressive and original way. I don't think it's overpriced at all. If anything, I would have thought, I mean, obviously...
Could have gone for 10 euros.
Yeah. Why not round it up? But yeah. I think the more, and something Steve said earlier on, the more focused and curated it is for that audience. People look less and less at price and more and more, I want to be part of that universe. So we find this with Town & Country. So we launched Town & Country this year, 2 issues. We're going up to 4 issues next year because we're getting that kind of response. It's very targeted. It's not about price. It's about a certain kind of demo, a certain kind of sensibility, a certain kind of, in particular, production value, you know. So the paper has got to be good. So we just went for the best paper as opposed to different types of paper.
Steve, just you're jotting down notes. Maybe you're finishing your business plans. I'm not sure. But
yeah, it's done now. Yeah, I finished. Yeah.
What were your impressions of Flow?
I mean, I think that's just, it's so positive. You know, it reminds me, just looking at it, reminds me of something like Dumbo Feather in Australia. You know, in terms of the content, that kind of mindfulness and this kind of, you know, sudden realization that there's a broadly female market very interested in this kind of mindful approach to the world. They're using the different paper stocks to kind of, to present something distinctive. I think what's really interesting for me is that it was bought. So it was brought in from another territory.
Absolutely.
And someone's made a great success of it. I mean, the Delayed Gratification have just finished their first Korean issue. So there's an example of a small independent magazine that's being relaunched in new territory. That looks like it could be a huge potential area.
Just on the purposes of review, we're getting close to the end of the program. You brought in some titles. This is a bit of a review. Do you want to sort of pick 3 that stand out to you, Steve, in terms of, I know it's going to be difficult. You can go through all of them quickly, but if we look back at the last year, 3 titles that you really thought did something interesting.
Okay, so selecting from my pile. Brewster Magazine, which I may have talked about here before, an Australian magazine, which is made by a group of guys who realized, so they work for a mainstream magazine and were researching some archive shots, realized that there are all these stereoscopic images that exist out there, and that if you took these stereoscopic images, a stereoscope being this kind of like the first portable 3D viewer, put 2 images in like a little binocular thing, they overlay over each other and create a 3D image. You take those images, run them through Photoshop, tweak up the red and blue channels, and you can create modern 3D images. They pair that with a piece of contemporary publishing from the time, and you've got a mini travel magazine that travels not just through space, but through time. It's wonderful. Absolutely lovely.
Brilliant. You've got, you pulled out Colours.
Yeah, Colours was specifically the
football edition. Yep.
Football edition, which obviously came out around the World Cup and was just a fantastic example of why Colours is so good. Because at the time when everyone was telling football stories in a very particular brand-led way, Colours took this completely different perspective, used the kind of metaphor of a Panini sticker album to create a whole magazine, which is essentially one long story about the many different faces of football around the world. Just absolutely terrific.
And which is interesting because yet, you know, the magazine is still underwritten by a brand, but yet they completely divorce it from a brand, which is fascinating to,
exactly,
to
exactly,
see.
Exactly, exactly.
And finally, you've got Outpost. I
know it's been talked about a million times before, but I'm a big fan of independent publishing that I think has a real importance and purpose. This is publishing like I just don't see it anywhere else. That an original voice from inside the Arab world that somehow manages to get away from the censors and publish really, well, quite edgy kind of, sort of like view from the street. I just think it's really important and everyone should know about it.
And also, beautifully designed. I mean, it's a wonderful object.
Exactly.
At the same time. Ian, just... if you have to look back, one or two things, standouts of the year, either in print, closures, anything.
Well, I think from a business point of view, the year has been very much about consolidation. It's about becoming more lean. It's the rise of hubbing again, magazines working together. Mm. It's about the rise of that awful phrase, native advertising, native content. It's becoming more and more like an independent setup, actually. Mm. So it's interesting hearing everything Steve is saying, because I think we're meeting in the middle more. So it's all about lean thinking, lean startups. It's about virtual teams.
Yeah.
So increasingly, it's about full-time staff will be working over a group of titles, sympathetic titles.
Sure.
But they will be working across it from a positive point of view, because by working on something different, obviously it refreshes you to go back to what you were doing previously and looking at it in a different way.
And just to conclude on an independent note, do you think we've seen, of course, this extraordinary rise of independent publishing, probably over at this point of the last half decade, has that given a different type of fuel, not just to the editorial floor, but I think also when you sit in board meetings and planning as well, or does it confound a big company?
I think we should get closer. I think the bigger companies have been so focused on their bottom lines, so to speak. They become so obsessed by the move to digital that maybe a year or so ago, they lost the focus around print because they were so concerned about creating this new ecosystem and where the other revenue sources would come from. And I think what's beginning to happen now is they're beginning to realize the power of print through research, through things like the Renaissance, the blossoming of all these independent magazines. And I do think that maybe, in 2015, there's an opportunity for the two sides to come together more, because I think both could learn a lot from each other. The big backroom things that companies like Hearst have could well help in certain ways with smaller... So we would have that almost like a record company set up. So you'd have a Universal that feeds... and has the kind of backroom stuff for smaller independent labels.
Well, it sounds like Ian Birch just scripted the business plan for Hearst. I love the Universal record company analogy. Ian Birch from Hearst here on this side of the Atlantic, also Steve Watson from stackmagazines.com. Gentlemen, I have to leave it there. Wishing you a very, very Merry Christmas. And that brings us to the end of this 121st edition of The Stack. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And if you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back at the same time next Saturday. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, until next time, it's goodbye and a very Merry Christmas.